is his own report of what he saw and heard.
I can see this caravan by the light of the moon. There are six bullock carts, and each one is covered. And sitting up top, just under the matting, there are men dressed in long white robes and white turbans.
You've just heard a recording made a short time ago during a round-the-world trip. You're going to hear more of them in the next half hour. Altogether, they make up a story which we have called Towards the Happy Land. Our program is presented, transcribed by the American Broadcasting Company and United Nations Radio. It's in two parts, and it concerns Asia. To introduce part one, here is your host, John Daly.
This happy land is situated between the borders of dreams and reality. A small portion of it is located in the uplands of accomplishment. For many centuries, whole segments of humanity, particularly in the non-industrialized lands of the world, remained untouched by the benefits of civilization. But today, the peoples and the governments of these lands are demanding and working for a share of these benefits as their birthright. Helping them to succeed through economic cooperation and aid has become a top priority political issue in the capitals of the world. The issue is not merely political. Behind it lies the recognition of an enlightened self-interest. As President Eisenhower recently said, the steady growth of other nations, especially the less developed countries, will create new and growing demands for goods and services. It will produce an environment which will benefit both them and us. One of the world areas where big strides are being taken towards a better life is Asia. To observe the progress of the nations of this vast region towards this goal, United Nations Radio sent Irving Berenson on a 25,000-mile journey through five countries. This is his own report of what he saw and heard.
It isn't every day that a man has a chance to circumnavigate the globe and to take a penetrating look at countries he's never seen before. Yet, when this assignment came my way, it had me worried. How could I, in the short time I had available, cover several of what to me were unknown lands and come away with a real hard story of what they were doing? The answer came in the form of a 16-pound box, which I carried slung over my right shoulder, or hung about my neck, or resting on my lap, for many thousand miles. This was a tape recorder, and believe me, by the time I finished half my journey, it seemed to weigh 16 tons. But the 16-pound box was the answer, for with it I could tell the story of five Asian nations, not only in my own words, but in the voices of the people themselves, the people and their helpers, the people who with their own hands and brains and sweat and toil were building bit by bit toward the happy land. The 16-pound box and I took off one day in mid-February, flying westward round the world. Destination, Asia. The trip was long, and during the many hours we spent over the night-clad Pacific, there was time to muse. So I conjured up the image of Asia induced by many works of fiction and of fact. You can't blame a man for having romanticized notions of lands he's never seen. Well, I thought of temples and bazaars, of rickshaws and water buffaloes, sampans floating on serpentine rivers, of junks and jungles and dancing girls. And presently...
May I have your attention, please? Ladies and gentlemen, we're coming in for a landing at Don Mueang Airport in Bangkok. Will you fasten your seat belts, please, and extinguish your cigarettes? Kindly remain in your seats until the plane has come to a full stop.
Bangkok, city of temples and klongs, the Emerald Buddha, the pantheon of kings in the towers of nine planets, Anna and the King of Siam, and the sinuous rhythms of the Siamese dance.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the Thailand I was about to see? Ancient monuments and a time-forgotten land. Well, the monuments were there, but so was this.
The main aspiration of Thailand is to raise the living standard of the people, especially the farmers who constitute about 85% of our population.
The 16-pound box and I were at work, recording Mr. Sunthorn Hungladaran. Mr. Sunthorn is the Secretary General of the National Economic Council of Thailand.
All our farmers have employment, but they are not fully employed. In practically all rice-growing areas, only one crop can be grown each year, and each rice crop occupies about 6 to 7 months of the year. So most of the Thai farmers are idle for the rest of the year. One remedy which has been applied with increasing intensity is to increase irrigation facilities, so that double cropping of rice and production of other crops might be possible. And the rehabilitation and expansion of the railways has also been a main preoccupation of our country, not to mention the improvement of the facilities of the port of Bangkok, whereby deep draft ocean-going vessels are enabled to go right up to Bangkok to load and unload cargoes.
So there was another Thailand behind the glittering domes. I left the sightseeing for the tourists and set forth on the trail of Mr. Sunthorn's Thailand. Quickly, by car, in the heat of the late morning, to Klang Toi, the port of Bangkok. A ceremonious greeting by General Nakrob, director of the port authority, who invited his advisor to accompany me. Together, we climbed four stories to a vantage point overlooking the port.
This is a most businesslike-looking harbor. And I have with me here on the roof of this building Mr. G.L. Beckett, who is General Advisor to the Port Authority of Thailand. Mr. Beckett, what is this body of water on which the port is located?
This is the River Chao Phraya.
How far are we from the open sea?
About 25 miles.
And ocean-going vessels can come up this far?
Yes, they can. We are now dredging the Bar Channel, and we are deepening it, and by June of this year, we hope to have it down to its full project depth, which will allow ships of 28 to 29 feet to come in at high water.
What are the ships out in midstream doing?
The ships are loading in the midstream. Although some ships load on the wharf, most of them go out in midstream and load overside from lighters.
How many ships are there in port today, Mr. Beckett?
We've got 9 here this morning. There's one opposite where we're standing now, a Danish ship loading timber, teak and yang timber. And upriver, towards the end of the wharf, you'll see that long white ship, which is passenger and cargo ship, the Selandia of the East Asiatic Company.
There is an impressive number of electrically driven cranes here. How many do you have?
We have 12 electric semi-portal level-luffing travelling wharf cranes.
How about the railway?
The port was designed to be a railway port, but we have found that most of the traffic is handled by road transport, although now Bangkok has become the port of entry for imports to the country of Laos.
Mr. Beckett, the measure of the prosperity of any country, I believe, is the amount of activity in its harbour. I understand that there are plans for the expansion of this port of Bangkok.
This is one of the most modern ports in the Far East today. And I think Thailand is a developing country, and this city of Bangkok is certainly growing. And I would say that the future of the port of Bangkok is certainly bright.
What was that he said? Electric semi-portal, level-luffing, traveling wharf cranes? Well, this was hardly a time-forgotten land. The next morning, I followed Mr. Sunthorn's trail once more. Diversified crops, he said. For these, I sped upriver to the central highland, to the rice bowl of the world. Upriver in a speedboat of the Royal Irrigation Department. This was the Supon River, It turned and twisted through plains and jungle. We sped past water buffaloes, past sampans laden with rice and timber, and large passenger launches crowded with travelers, among whom the orange-robed Buddhist priests were numerous. Finally, hours later, our boat slowed down and stopped in a paradise called Samchuk. It was there that I met Professor Balakrishnan, a tall, erect Indian whose white hair peeped out from beneath his tropical helmet. The professor is a veritable one-man revolution, an agricultural and industrial revolution, this one stimulated by the government of Thailand itself. I stood with him on an embankment, looking over the Samchuk Irrigation Agronomy Farm, and with the late afternoon breeze crackling across the microphone, let the professor tell his own story.
Last year, if you had stood at this place, you would have seen all around only yellow fields and patches of charred plants everywhere. Now you see green. Only in our farm, but this is what Thailand is going to be with irrigation agronomy extending. Our experiments at Samchuk have shown that not only rice, but practically every soil can be grown here. As a matter of fact, I have been telling some of my colleagues here, if they plant a walking stick here, it will sprout out. So fertile is the soil, so nice is the climate, and so plentiful is the supply of water.
Well, sir, now let's come back to your mission here. Would you tell us what that is, please?
To try various crops and different varieties of the same, in addition to rice, to disseminate this knowledge amongst the farmers of this area so that fruitful results obtained on this farm might be extended to them. And thirdly, to train Thai technical personnel to conduct properly laid out agronomic experiments with correct interpretation of results. One thing that we have achieved remarkable success with is the sugarcane which you see in that field over there. It's only 9 months old and it has already reached a height of 5 meters. That is a remarkable achievement, and I am happy because this has been taken up immediately by a very enterprising corporation in Thailand who have started a factory following the work here only 6 kilometers from this farm, and only last week the foundation stone therefore was laid, and they are going to make Thailand self-sufficient for sugar.
Well, Professor Balakrishnan, in addition to the sugarcane which you have growing there, I see some other crops. What are they?
Oh, the one which you see in the other field there is maize. And this side we have got the jute. And just over the other side we had a very good crop of potato. It followed rice. And now I have removed it, and after lifting the tubers, I have put peanut. And it's a very wonderful experiment because I feel that 3 crops in a year can be raised. All these will certainly add to the happiness of the farmer and the economy of the whole country.
I could already see a land of tall green crops all year long, instead of the charred fields left behind when the Thai farmers burn the stubble of rice straw. But green crops presuppose irrigation. Can Thailand manage to water its rice bowl all year round? This time I followed the irrigation trail, up the Supon River once again next morning, through many more hours of jungle scenery. And finally we emerged upon the broad bosom of the Chao Phya River and turned south in a driving rain squall which sped by in literally minutes. Soon we saw right across the stream and rising high above the banks the Chinat Dam. No golden swayback temple roofs at Chinat. No towers of the 9 planets. Instead, a forest of cranes and masts. I clambered high above the waterline to the catwalk of the dam.
If you've ever dreamt that you were standing on 1 foot on top of the Empire State Building, you might have some idea of how I just felt, crossing catwalks and scrambling over iron girders to reach the point from which I'm speaking now, the center of the Chinat Dam over the Chao Phya River. All about us, the sounds of construction, for above this plain, they rise almost incongruously, masts of derricks, of a dredge, and the great works of this dam at Chinat. I'm here with Mr. Kanak Pranich, the assistant chief engineer of this project, which will help to irrigate some 3 million additional acres of the rice bowl of Thailand. What is the main purpose of this China Dam, Mr. Pranit?
The main purpose of this dam is to raise the water in the river so that the river will fill its bank all year round and then can be irrigated into the farm.
How wide is this dam?
The dam is altogether 300 meters wide.
It's 300 meters or some 900 feet wide. And how much above the present level will this dam raise the water of the Chao Phraya River?
It will fill its bank all year round.
It's getting very noisy up here. Perhaps, Canuck, we'd better find some other place to broadcast without the noise of this machinery going on. We've left the scene of construction now, and we've come back to the veranda of Canuck's house here in a veritable Shangri-La. How many people have been working on this dam, Canuck?
We have altogether about 2,500 workmen.
Well, this is a very large project, and I take it that it wasn't planned just a few months ago.
This project was conceived around 60 years ago, in the time of King Rama V. At that time, Thailand, or Siam, began to export rice, and the king felt something had to be done with the irrigation in order to stabilize the production of rice.
Well, now, this is going to make water available during the normal dry season for the irrigation of other crops.
Yes, that's quite right. Actually, the Chao Phraya River in the wet season has about 50 times more discharge than in the dry season. So, when the dam is completed, we can irrigate even in the dry season. When the river level is raised, communication and transportation by means of Chao Phraya River will be made possible all year round. We consider our Chao Phraya River as our lifeline of Thailand.
I wish I had time to tell you more about Chinat, whose dam will be inaugurated next year on the 2500th anniversary of the ascension of the Lord Buddha to Nirvana. But I'm sure you get the idea of the new Thailand, and we must move on. On this time, just across the border, to Burma. Surnamed the land of the golden pagodas, Burma, too, is a country intensely devoted to Buddhism. Towering high above Rangoon, the capital, the Shwedagon Pagoda points its gleaming spire toward the heavens. Surely the chant of monks and priests resounds in Burma. But the 16-pound box and I caught something else as well.
Burma is largely agricultural, and before the war, we had hardly any industries, besides from those which are based in agriculture, namely rice mills and timber mills. After the war, we have tried to plan to diversify our economy, not only by diversifying our agriculture, but also by providing new industries. For example, we now have a spinning and weaving factory. We had only one sugar factory. We have got two more under construction.
The Honorable U Rashid was speaking. U Rashid is the Minister of Trade Development and Labor.
We are putting up a jute factory. We are also erecting a steel factory. We had only a few hundred primary schools. Now we have several thousands all over the country. We had hardly any social welfare workers before the war, but now there's a concerted effort to improve social welfare in the country. We have revised all our existing labor legislation and introduced new laws to bring labor conditions in the country with the level of many of the progressive countries in the world. About the third half of 1952, we tried to correlate all these programs, and the whole thing was called the PDOTA program, which means happy land. And the objective now is to move slowly in all these fields towards this happy land.
PDOTA, the Honorable U Rashid said, the happy land. But it also means a country where the welfare of the people is a state responsibility. How does the state help? Here's an example.
I'm sitting in an office here in Rangoon, and though this office is not very different from others in the city of Rangoon, something exceptional goes on here. This is the office of U Chit Toon, who is the executive secretary of the Industrial Loans Board. I'm going to ask U Chit Toon if he'll be good enough to tell us what the story is behind this board.
The Industrial Loans Board was formed in October of last year to provide industrial loans to those needing help to build up their own industries so that we could balance our consumers' goods production compared to the agricultural produce which we are producing annually and for which the markets are not being as favorable as before.
Well, now, what is the average loan which the Industrial Loans Board gives to people who apply?
The average loan is about jets, 200,000. It would be equivalent to about $50,000.
And here in the office of the Industrial Loans Board of the Government of Burma, we have a young lady named Ma Soa Tin, who I understand is preparing to develop a paint factory. I wonder if you'd tell us the story behind your plans, Ma Soa Tin.
At present, we have to import lead paints required for use in our country. The prices are very high at the moment. So as we have lead as a raw material in this country, we hope to manufacture paints here out of lead.
Is this your own idea? Is this your own business?
Yes. It's between me and my elder sister.
Is it usual or unusual in Burma for ladies to go into business enterprises by themselves?
I think it's quite usual. There are many ladies, you see, besides myself, who are already in business.
Well, Ma Soa Tin, what did you do when you had this idea of developing your paint factory?
I went to Japan last September to visit some of the paints manufacturing factories there.
Well, what about the capital?
The Industrial Development Corporation are helping us for the purchase of the plant.
Would this have been possible for you to do 10 years ago or 15 years ago if you'd had an idea and wanted to develop an industry of your own?
I don't suppose we'd have been able to do so for want of capital.
How many people do you think your plant will employ?
About 20 people, including two foreign technicians.
What do you think this will do for the Burmese people?
Well, it'll help them to get paints at a cheaper price, employment for the people.
Does this become a personal thing, or do people in your position see this as part of the development of a whole country?
As a businesswoman, I suppose I'm inclined to look upon my factory in terms of profit and loss. But in a larger sense, I know that the sort of thing I'm doing with help from my government is a big thing for Burma. It is a kind of beginning of an industrial awakening of my land and my people.
In a land whose people are just beginning their industrial development, it was interesting to learn how extensive their plans are. One evening, I met a young man with a lot of work ahead of him, Dr. Freddie Bahli of the Applied Research Institute of Burma.
Dr. Bahli, what would you say is the status of atomic energy development and research in Burma today?
I would say that we are being very enthusiastically supported by our government in the application of atomic energy for peaceful purposes. Primarily, of course, we are interested in the industrial utilization of atomic energy to produce cheap electricity. Also, of course, we are interested in the health and other applications of atomic energy. I'm sure that with all the power that we can get from the atomic reactors, our industrialization program will have gone a long way ahead with the fertilizers and so on that we would get. The agricultural products of our country, which are already quite large, will be even more, maybe doubled, and that the health of our people, especially people suffering from cancer and so on, will have been greatly alleviated. And I'm sure that this picture will be very, very bright.
Atomic reactors and the industrialization program, he said. This took me back to the Honorable U Rashid, who also spoke of a new steel plant. What about it?
On a broad plain along the Rangoon River, just outside the capital of Burma, there's an enormous skeleton. It's a steel skeleton. And it's the framework of the government steel rolling mill that's being erected here. We're sitting in the construction office here of this steel plant, On the walls all about us, there are charts and graphs. And with me in this office are Uong Kin, the chairman of the steel mill construction, and Mr. Salgado, who is the project manager. Uong Kin, is this the first mill of its kind in your country?
Yes, this is the first steel rolling mill that the government has set up here.
And what kind of products will this mill turn out?
Roofing sheets and the wire products in way of wire nails, screws, and bolts that we mostly use for our reconstruction purpose.
How many people do you think will be employed in this giant mill when it's completed?
We expect, you see, up to about 1,000 men would be employed in our mill.
What is the feeling of a Burmese citizen when he sees going up on this plane outside the capital a steel mill of this magnitude?
They were very enthusiastic about this. They never anticipate that such thing can be made here in Burma before. And when they were told that we're going to make iron sheet out of the scrap that is lying on the way, they could not believe, you see, that they are only waiting the time they will produce.
Well, we have here Mr. Salgado. What would you say is the greatest need in the development of the steel industry in Burma?
Trained personnel. We are, for the initial stages, going to import a number of foreign technicians under whom we expect to have a sufficiently trained force of our own technicians to take over the industry from these people.
Can you estimate at this point whether or not the people of Burma are likely to adapt themselves to an industrial civilization such as that which must surround steel mills and textile plants?
I can say this. We've had very encouraging results even during the construction period. We have taken ordinary unskilled labor who during this period have been trained quite satisfactorily, and even the construction engineers on this project were very enthusiastic about the speed with which our people have learned the jobs. Every day we have scores of visitors, and as a matter of fact, quite a lot of our construction is impeded by the number of visitors that do come out to see us.
All this, then, is the blueprint for the happy land. You mustn't think it's ready-built as yet. We've had time here for only a few examples of the new Asia, and there's a long road stretching out ahead. But this much we can say. The road has been surveyed and charted. The land itself is still located between the borders of dreams and reality. The small portion we've described is that part on the uplands of accomplishment. Pi Do Tha is a Burmese slogan, as we've said. But where it points, with differences perhaps in curves and grades, is surely the goal of many lands, and the future, let us hope, of many peoples. You've been listening to part one of the program called Towards the Happy Land. This evening, we have taken you to Thailand and to Burma. Next Friday, Irving Berenson and his tape recorder will take you on a visit to Indonesia, India, and Pakistan. We invite you to join us again next Friday. Towards the Happy Land, produced and transcribed by the American Broadcasting Company and United Nations Radio, is another in a series of programs reviewing major issues before the world today. That recording you've heard was made a few weeks ago during a round-the-world trip. You'll hear more of these recordings in the next half hour. Altogether, they make up the final episode of a story we've called Toward the Happy Land. Our program is presented transcribed by the American Broadcasting Company and United Nations Radio. It concerns Asia. Now, to introduce the program, your host, John Daly.
A week ago, we took you on a journey to a part of the Happy Land. It is located, we said, between the borders of dreams and reality. A small portion of it lies in the uplands of accomplishment. Tonight, we join our expedition once again and look to further explorations. In this series, we are concerned with a continent and many peoples whom the progress of steady industrial development has largely bypassed in our times. Today, these people and their governments expect and are striving to obtain a share of the benefits of modern civilization as their due. Industrialization is the key word of their plans and the established goal of their national effort. Helping them achieve this industrialization is today a top priority issue in the councils of the United Nations and the chancelleries of the world. First, two-thirds of mankind need to be raised from a life on the fringes of need and hunger. And there is also the hard-headed realization that no nation or group of nations can prosper in economic isolation, and that the poverty of one limits the advancement of the others. Asia is a great stage upon which is played a drama, pointing the way to a better life for countless millions of human beings. To observe the progress of the nations of this vast area, United Nations Radio recently sent Irving Berenson on a 25,000-mile journey through five countries. Last week, he took us with him to two of those lands. Here now is his own report of what he saw and heard in the remaining three.
We were on our way together, my tape recorder and I. Burma and Thailand were behind us. Ahead of us, the third country out of five. Where is it? From the northwest highlands of Sumatra, stretching in a wide arc toward the Philippines, then southward to the Arafura Sea, lies Indonesia. As if to puzzle amateur geographers, many of its once familiar names have now been changed. Borneo is Kalimantan, Celebes is Sulawesi, and the capital as well has resumed an ancient name, Jakarta. But to the world at large, one name cannot change, a name that really rings a bell, Bali. We knew that we could find this music in Indonesia, and we did. But we also found something else.
The first objective is to improve the standard of living of the population. Our approach is so far to draw up a program that would increase our production efficiency, especially in the first 5 years in the economic sector. Of course, we seek progress also in the social sector, in the sector of health improvement and labor conditions. Quite a lot has to be done. But we feel, in the first place, we must give attention to the increase of production of national income.
The words of Dr. R. Juanda. He is the state minister for planning. Assisting his bureau in the preparation of a development plan are 10 experts sent by the United Nations at Indonesia's request. Dr. Juanda spoke to us of many projects on which planning is in progress. He gave us many examples of what Indonesia can do and intends doing.
Take, for instance, cement factories. All the raw materials, practically, are available here. It would save us every year millions and millions of dollars. And I think we have to enter as soon as possible into this type of business. There are quite a number of other examples, like, for instance, glass factories, paper factories, ceramic factories. And so, in the industrial sector, we find quite a number of high-priority projects to increase productivity and to replace imports.
Increase productivity, Dr. Juanda said. We went to find examples of new efficiency in this once non-mechanized land. We found one in a place called Plered.
I'm standing under a very hot tropical sky. The sun is shining down upon this beautiful village of Plered in Indonesia. In front of me, there's an embankment over which the railroad passes. On the other side of it, there are mountains visible, all about us, palm trees. And now, as I turn, I look at a very modern building. Approaching this and walking inside, we hear the sound of electrically driven machinery. Let's listen to this machine. Now we come over to Mr. Ateng, who directs this factory. What do you do in this shed with all of this material, Mr. Ateng?
In this factory, we are making raw materials needed for making earthenware.
In other words, you're preparing clay. You have good clay here.
Yes, we have good clay.
What do you do with this clay when it's all prepared?
We distribute it to the several units where the clay will be made into earthenware.
When you say several units, do you mean several units of this same factory?
Yes, the units are members of the whole factory. This factory is the mother center of all, and the units are members of this.
This factory is the mother center, you said.
Yes.
Is that why it's called an Induk?
Yes, that is the reason of it.
As I understand it, Induk is the word for parent or mother.
For mother.
And this is the portion of the cooperative which produces better clay than any one of them would have been able to produce in it before this
better
factory
quality.
Was built.
Yes. The production of the units and the factory itself are better quality than the previous production of Plaret. For in the long ago, in Plaret, we have several hundreds of house industries or small-scale industries, and now we are improving it into a better industry with better raw materials and with better quality too.
Yes, the new sounds of Asia certainly were there. We could have heard and recorded many more. But time, as it is said, was on the wing. And so were we, my tape recorder and I. This time, destination India. Lulled again by throbbing engines high above the seas, we thought of legendary India. The Taj Mahal, of course, and Maharajas, and Fakirs. And naturally, we thought of sounds like these. Certainly we saw the Taj and heard that music, but we heard this too.
The immediate objective of the first five-year plan was to increase the production of food and raw materials and to correct the inflationary pressures that were strong at the time. Simultaneously, the plan aimed at creating conditions which would enable the country to take more rapid strides towards development in the coming years.
This was Mr. H.M. Patel of India's National Planning Board. Was that first five-year plan he spoke of a success?
The immediate objectives of the plan, one would say, with confidence, have been achieved. Agricultural production has increased by about 20%. Industrial production has gone up by about 40%, and prices are now at more reasonable levels. National income has increased faster than was initially expected, and consumption standards have risen moderately. The second plan is intended not only to secure a bigger rise in national income, but also to create employment opportunities on a large scale. In a democratic country, living standards cannot be depressed beyond a point. In fact, they should rise visibly and progressively. As a result of the first five-year plan, per capita incomes have increased by about 10%, and in the second five-year plan, they will increase by another 18%. It is a fair judgment to say that by the end of the second plan, a visible impression will have been made on the purchasing power of the masses and on their living standards.
The masses, Mr. Patel had said, where are they to be found in India? Mostly in the 700,000 villages. So we went next to a village called Dahar, to a village in the Punjab.
Here in the village of Dahar, from which we're speaking, the NES, or National Extension Service, has been at work, I believe, for some 16 months. I'm sitting in the village square here. In a semicircle in front of this building, we have perhaps 40 or 50 young people looking with great eagerness to see what's happening here. We have the village chief and the elders. Well, we're going to find out what makes Dahar tick. And the man who's going to tell us is Mr. V.P. Dhawan of the NES, who is in charge of developments in this area.
Well, Mr. Paranson, the main occupation of people in this area is agriculture. So our attempt has been to supply them improved seed, and improved implements, and these chemical fertilizers, and to assist them with technical guidance, which will bring in a rapid increase in production.
Would you say that in the 16 months in which you've been working here, there has been a tangible increase in production so that the income of these villages has been improved?
Well, I can definitely say that there has been an increase of about 10 to 15% in the income of the village people, see. So there is a lot of enthusiasm in people, see, for these development works for that very reason. For example, in the village of Dahar, you have seen new streets being paved and drains being constructed, and a community center has been set up by the village people. And not only this, the village people have, during the last 1.5 years, collected 12,000 to 13,000 rupees and put up a school building. You have seen on the roadside, there is a children park also attached to this school building. And this is in itself an example of the self-help and enthusiasm which is prevailing in the people. I think if this speed continues, the progress in villages will be very substantial and the very look of the villages will change. Our population consists of about 80% people living in villages. And when these 80% are happy, content with their boys and girls educated, sources of income almost double than the present ones, the very look of India, rural India, will change.
Indeed, the very look of India has been changed. The look, for example, of a once untamed river, the Barakar. I saw it first at Maithon. There, in the Damodar Valley in Bengal and Bihar, this river is being put to useful purpose by the DVC, the Damodar Valley Corporation. This is how I saw it.
As I look around the scenery at Maithon, I seem to be standing in a kind of amphitheater. All about us there is a man-made ring of earth and masonry, which all put together are forming part of a great multiple-purpose river basin development, which will add very much to the economy and to the happiness of India. Down below, where I'm standing with Mrs. Roy of the Damodar Valley Corporation, there's a small trickle of water now, comparatively, but that's because this is the dry season, and that water is rushing down to join the Damodar River. Once upon a time, this water was a very serious menace to the people who lived in this region. But I'd like to get the story from Mrs. Roy.
Practically every year, as far as history records, there have been terrible floods in the lower valley, mostly affecting Bengal. And the last of these was in 1943, which did, if not the biggest, certainly did a great deal of damage. And apart from overrunning fields and damaging crops and property and breaking up homes, it also breached the railway lines and delayed the war effort, which made the government sit up and take notice. And they held a flood inquiry commission. And at that commission, they decided to build a series of storage reservoirs to control the river. And since they were doing that, they made it multi-purpose. And the whole idea is to control floods and to generate power and irrigate about 1 million acres of land. And along with these, we'll have soil conservation and land reclamation, and also navigation to a certain extent for about 85 miles.
Above our heads, there is a series of power lines. Where do they come from and where are they going, Mrs. Roy?
All these dams will have hydroelectric attachments and will be distributed through a common grid system. But as we have mentioned before, the whole Damodar River is a seasonal river, and the peak power will be generated only in the monsoon. So to even up the seasonal fluctuation, we built a thermal power station with an ultimate capacity of 200,000 kilowatts at Bokaro. And at the moment, that is in operation, and the power is coming from Bokaro.
Where is it going to?
Just at the moment, from Maithon, it's going to the locomotive works at Chittaranjan and the Hindustan cable works also. But ultimately, it'll go down to Calcutta when our substation will be complete there.
The thermal power station at Bokaro, Mrs. Roy had said. We drove there quickly through the dark of night. The road led through a jungle, climbed a hill, and suddenly looked down upon a valley full of light. In it stood Bokaro. On its wall, a plaque. Dedicated, it said, to the people of the valley. Inside, giant turbines, and a conversation with Mr. Lahiri, the general superintendent.
Here at the Bokaro plant, there's a great complex of railway tracks and transformer stations and the great power plant itself with its turbines, which you can possibly hear humming in the background. We're speaking now from the master control. Here is an announcement. Coming over the public address system. I wonder if you'd tell us, Mr. Lahiri, what is the capacity of the Bokaro thermal power plant?
At the moment, we have got 350 megawatt generators. But we have room for a fourth one. It may be another 50. That means this station will be 200,000 kilowatt.
How about your staff? Do you have a trained personnel here, or are you training your men as you go along?
That's a very interesting question. Before we started, we had 10 engineers, Indian engineers taken from industry, various places, and they were sent to America. Then they came back, and they all hold key position in the operation and maintenance of this plant.
How about the money for this huge enterprise?
Well, a lot of it came from the International Bank. International Bank gave us loan in two stages. The first loan was $18.5 million. And most of the cost for Bokaro came from that funds.
One final question, Mr. Lahiri. What was the reaction of the people who live in this large valley when they saw this giant power plant go up and when they come past and watch it now at night?
They are very much thrilled to see a power station like that. But we are not satisfied by just that thrill. We shall be happy when this electricity is used by the people here.
As I left Bokaro at midnight, I stopped along the highway to record some ancient sounds of travel. I thought of that caravan, of those bullock carts, a few nights later, when I joined a train. A special air-conditioned train of the most modern type, set up by the Indian government. It carried a group of railway experts from the United Nations Economic Commission for Asia and the Far East all over the country. On that train was Mr. A. Oberoi of the Indian Railways. This is what he told us.
The entire train is of Indian manufacture. All these air-conditioned coaches and other upper-class coaches are now being made in our own country. These air-conditioned coaches are running on almost all our long-distance mail and express trains. We are now planning to run an air-conditioned third-class train between Delhi and Bombay. By the time our second five-year plan unfolds itself, I think we shall have reached self-sufficiency in almost all important directions in the matter of running railways. By 1961, I think there'll be no need for importing any of the rolling stock.
There was much else to be seen in India, but time calls once again, and we must travel westward to another country, Pakistan.
After partition, the country was almost completely undeveloped so far as industry was concerned and was dependent on imports from abroad for a large number of essential consumer goods. Great emphasis had therefore to be given to the development of industry, particularly industries in which the local raw materials were to be processed. And in this respect, very great progress has been made. Two of the very important raw materials of Pakistan, namely raw cotton and raw jute, which had to be exported and processed to the foreign countries, are now being converted into manufactured goods within the country.
That was Mr. Latif Qureshi speaking for the Government Planning Board of Pakistan. He's the board's chief economist.
The cotton textile industry has had a very remarkable development. Similarly, the jute goods industry has also been developed. Another problem is that the national income is small, and all developmental activity will have therefore to be concentrated in the direction of increasing the national income, so that there should be larger resources available for development, and at the same time it should be possible to raise the standard of living of the people substantially.
It wasn't difficult to see these plans in action. Traveling barely 20 minutes from Karachi, I saw how the sandy desert had been transformed. Along the road stood factories and plants, new and gleaming. Textile mills, oil refineries, electrical equipment works, automobile assembly plants, and chemical factories. And some miles away, industry of a different kind, but no less important for the living standards of Pakistan.
We have come into what we may describe as a small cottage industry. The background sound is the sound of a handloom being operated and on which cloth is being woven. I'm here with Mrs. Faridi of APWA, the All Pakistan Women's Association, and I'm going to ask Mrs. Faridi if she will describe this small family industry to us in this shelter.
This is a refugee family, and as you see, there are a number of children, a wife and a husband. While the wife does the spinning, the husband is doing the weaving, and also one of the little boys in the family. The children usually sit and sort out the cotton. We try as far as possible as an organization to see that they're put into schools. We are now building a craftsman's colony, and I'm going to show you this craftsman's colony, where we hope to give them better accommodation, because we feel that we can only get the best work from them, and when they're happy craftsmen and they live a life where they have some of their needs, if not all their needs, fulfilled. As you know, social security is extremely important to any working man or woman or child.
What is the importance of industry of this kind in a single family to the overall economy of Pakistan?
It is extremely important. For one thing, I think from the point of view of social welfare, it keeps the family together. It prevents the men of the family, shall I say, from straying. It helps the family to keep together as a unit in which every member of the family is contributing towards the earning of the family. And that, I think, as a social worker, that is one of the very important aspects of having these cottage industries. I do realize that as industrialization comes in, their family life and the cultural pattern in this very home is going to change. But whether it's going to be for the better or for the worse, of course, time will judge.
Well, progress can be measured in various ways. Here's another way it's measured. I recorded this story in the diesel maintenance shops in Pakistan's capital, Karachi.
It is said that a mile measures 5,280 feet. This is undoubtedly correct. A linear mile does measure that from a purely scientific point of view. But there's another way of measuring the distance of a mile, and this depends entirely upon the way in which a human being can travel that distance. Well, now here in Pakistan, something new has been added in the way of negotiating 1 mile or 1,000 miles, and that is a series of new, giant diesel locomotives for the railways of Pakistan. Now with me is Mr. Puri of the Pakistan Railways. Mr. Puri, you have a large number, I believe, of these very big road-switching engines.
We have a total fleet of 92 diesel-electric locomotives on our railroad system.
I'd like to ask you, Mr. Puri, if these locomotives are used indifferently on passenger and freight services.
We use these ALCO road freight locomotives and Clyde freight type locomotives mostly on passenger services and the switchers on freight services. Now, as you know, this diesel electric locomotives takes our fast passenger trains from Karachi right up to Lahore, a distance of 956 miles, without any taking any water or fuel in between. Which was not the case in case of a steam locomotives. We had to stop the steam locomotives after every 50 100 miles for water and change the steam locomotives every 300 or 400 miles. With the result that three locomotives had to work this very fast passenger train from Karachi to Lahore, which is now being hauled by a single ALCO or a Clyde 1600 horsepower locomotive from Karachi to Lahore.
Here comes another one of these diesel engines alongside us. This locomotive that's coming in now is a very large one. It's painted in green and white, which are the colors of the Pakistani flag. On the side is the legend Northwestern. This one is called the City of
Ceylon.
That train moved on, and so must we. We come to the end of our journey. Together now, we've traveled many miles through many lands. We've gone through cottage workshops, plants, and mills. We've looked up at dams and down on dynamos. We've been through villages, on bullock carts. We've taken air-conditioned trains to famous cities. We've talked of harbors and of health, of labor laws and of social progress. It was of all these things put together that the Honorable U Rashid had told us in Burma.
We tried to correlate all these programs, and the whole thing was called the PDODA program, which means happy land. And the objective now is to move slowly in all these fields towards this happy land.
PDODA, the happy land. Progress toward it must be slow. To catch up with the centuries is no easy task. What we have seen, of course, is just a start. But that start has been made. And on the road to progress, these lands of Asia are not alone. Working with them at their request are the United Nations, its agencies, its funds, its technical assistance program. UN planners, engineers, technicians, doctors, educators, administrators, a host of dedicated people are in the field with all their skills and services. And then still others, and other funds as well, have come from long-developed and wealthier nations, for it's realized today that the poverty of one limits the advancement of others. So together, for a better world, the poor, the rich, the developed, the developing, the governments, the individuals, single nations and nations grouped together, and the United Nations, all are striving toward the happy land.
Irving Berenson and his tape recorder have just brought you the final episode of Toward the Happy Land. Major portions of this program were recorded in Asia. Produced and transcribed by the American Broadcasting Company and United Nations Radio, this was another in a series of programs reviewing major issues and developments in the world today.